Blog Talk Radio.
Because we're the Houston Oilers. Houston Oilers. Houston Oilers number one. Yes, we're the Houston Oilers. Houston Oilers. Houston Oilers number one.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to Ballard Radio. My name is Matt Weston, and tonight we're joined by our favorite non-American citizen, Luke Beggs. How are you doing today?
I am doing great. I am so proud to have gained such distinction amongst our ranks as a non-American and as a favorite. So that's the best of both worlds, really.
Yeah, we all have to be known for something. America is the only thing that matters. We're ethnocentrists here. Or I am, at least. I don't know anything else about the rest of the world. So that's the one that's interesting about you whatsoever. Are not an American, and
yes.
And that's a fact. It's not, I guess, an insult like how it's used around here sometimes.
Yeah, just get by calling somebody not an American. No, it's gonna be fun. I've got a plan for educating some Americans about, you know, other countries and other people and what the world is like outside of America, but we'll leave that for later.
Yeah, that's what the show's going to be. So today we're going to talk about the Seahawks game, briefly preview the Colts game, because there really isn't a whole lot to preview, because the Colts are a football team, I guess, in the literal sense of the word, but if you add any abstract thought to it, they're not a football team at all whatsoever. And then we'll end with a fun game called Ireland. Does it have it? And that's going to be today's show. So, Luke, did you know that the Texans have a really good offense and a really bad – or no, not a really bad, but a bad defense?
I mean, I thought it was the other way around. Are you sure you're just not getting that mixed up in any way, shape, or form?
No, it's really incredible just how quickly things can change. You know, life can change, how fragile reality is. And so the Texans lost to Seattle 41-38. And answered, I guess, two big questions that I had during this loss. The first was that, you know, the offense had been great against bad pass defenses. You know, Cleveland, New England, but they struggled against Cincinnati, and, of course, it was on a short week and Watson's first start, but they still have a pretty good defense, and Houston still struggled. And also against Kansas City, the offense struggled too. And, yeah, I know that Watson had a better second half, you know, when they were already down by more than two possessions, but overall, you know, they didn't have that good of an offensive performance in that game. And so it's kind of unknown whether or not this passing offense was actually, you know, any good or not. And the second question was, you know, the defense. They lost J.J. Watt, Wendy Merciless. The only game that they played without both those players was against the Cleveland Browns, who have the worst passing offense in the NFL. Deshaun Kizer has been the worst quarterback in the NFL this year. Not the most hated. Joe Flacco is the most hated quarterback in the NFL. But Kizer has been the worst this year. And holding Cleveland at 10 points, it really doesn't say a whole lot, no matter who you just lost on defense or not. In this game, the defense was really bad, the offense was really good, and life looks to have been completely a switch compared to the way it's been the last 3 years. So do you think that this offense is for real now after they put 38 points in the Seattle Seahawks?
I mean, it's hard to make a case against that, isn't it? Because we've had like 3 to 4 weeks of playing against really not good defenses, but this is the first time we've come up against one which is consensus seen as being very good. The Seahawks are really good. They've got a great deal of flexibility how they line up, how they can play things. Their pass rush is oftentimes really, really good. So, yeah, they were going to be a tough matchup, and yet, you know, Sean Watson just casually dropped 38 points on them, so for all intents and purposes, until proven otherwise, yeah, this offense is good. This offense is really quite good now, and I think it's such an alien thought to now have to accept that as, oh, this is the norm kind of going forward, but like it's insane how much has changed in 7 weeks. 7-8 weeks now, has it been, since Watson took over?
I guess this is what, week 9, they've played 7 games. So I guess 7 weeks is taken over officially.
Yeah, like you can even make an argument that like there's 7 weeks worth of tape there for teams like Seattle, teams like Kansas, who were a little bit later. Like, there is tape for them to look at and for them to plan against. And even with that, just Watson and the rest of the Texans offense just continue to keep plowing on. They continue to keep gaining yards. They continue to keep putting up obscene amounts of passing touchdowns to only two players, I might add. No one else. It's just Fuller and Hopkins. They're all going to them, which is a really weird statistic in and of itself. But,
Yeah, I was just in this Fuller numbers are just so spectacular. I think, he has like 13 catches and 6 touchdowns or something like that. That's off the top of the dome, so I don't know how entirely it's true, but his touchdown rate's like 55%.
Yeah, it's absolutely obscene. Like, I joked a few weeks ago in one of the email threads that was going around that setting the over-under for Will Fuller's touchdown numbers at the end of the season at 12 was, like, that was going to be ridiculous, because he's now going to break that. He's now easily going to break that, and we could be looking at something in the range of, heck, even 15 could be a little bit too low. And I know that's a ridiculous thing, but that's the pace that he's been on. And it's really indicative of just how Fuller's being used, is that he's still getting low amounts of targets. He's still getting, like, I think the most amount of receptions he's had so far this season has been 5 in one game. That's it. But whenever he gets the ball, he's usually in the end zone. It's insane how this actually happens. I don't know how to quantify it, really.
Yeah, and you mentioned, I guess, how he's been used. And, I mean, the majority of his throws are deep passes down the field. Do you think that these passes to Fuller are just how he wants to be used in the offense as far as Bill O'Brien goes, where they want to use him to take shots deep? Or is it more, Fuller's just getting open on these routes, one out of every, 7 deep routes that he runs. How are you seeing Fuller being used so far this year?
So, and this will kind of branch into how he was specifically used against the Seahawks. Fuller is really special in terms of you can't teach speed, and speed at a certain level can just break defense. So, take Seattle. They run a typical cover 3. Now, cover 3 is defined by 3 deep safeties, usually two, either a strong safety or a middle linebacker in the middle, saying you have 3 deep zones. The way you beat stuff like that is you put stress on zones. You essentially ask players to make a decision between committing to one guy or committing to another. So against the Seahawks, what the Texans did really, really well, and if you go on to NFL.com's Next Gen Stats and you take a look at DeAndre Hopkins and Will Fuller's route charts, you get to see there's a really clear picture of what the heck was happening. So in cover 3, what was happening was Fuller was running essentially a go route on one side of the field, whereas Hopkins would start from the other side of the field and run a slant, or he would run a crossing route. Now, what this does in essence is one of the zones to one side of the field, the deep zone, that has to cover Fuller. Meanwhile, Hopkins, when he's crossing the field, goes into the two zones of the middle linebackers, essentially throwing windows for when the quarterback can hit Hopkins or when he's matched up against linebackers. So Fuller's speed is taking away deep safety help. He's taking away deep safety help, and he was taking away corners, which is essentially leaving Hopkins matched up against strong safety Cam Chancellor, who can run with receivers like Hopkins, just not consistently, and linebackers like Bobby Wagner and K.J. Wright. So Fuller is to the offense what I think Clowney is to the defense. He's not always going to get the majority of the touches. He's not going to be a volume guy. But his mere presence alone and the physicality and what he can do just creates opportunities and creates space for all of the for everyone else around him.
Yeah, I think that's the best way to put it, too. I know I've learned a lot about reading things that you and Brad have done just for his passing coverage and route stuff, because that's kind of like all that stuff I've had to kind of like learn from watching the game, because I was involved in any of that when I played. I like offensive line play where I just like turn it on and I kind of put myself in someone else's shoes and it even makes sense or whatever. Kind of like NFL 2K5 where you could play first person football. But I mean, I think it's the best way to describe Fuller, where he's running these deep routes and you're making the safety pick, and Seattle plays with one safety deep. New England played a lot of cover 3-2 in that game, which is really surprising because, one, they don't have the center fielder. And also, Malcolm Butler's not really big, that much of a zone coverage corner. Stephen Gilmore is similar too. even though I don't think Gilmore's very good, but they're going to take that against Seattle. They have one safety deep, and they're using Fuller to make Earl Thomas have his decision made. And if he fakes it all, or if he has shows any sort of hesitation, Fuller already has beat him deep. That touchdown pass to Fuller, the first one that was their first score of that game, that was Earl Thomas just taking one step forward, pausing for 1 second, and Fuller already has him beat deep. And then all those other routes you're talking about where, Hopkins is getting open, you have Thomas kind of dropping out farther deeper in the field, and that's kind of opening things for him underneath that. But, yeah, I mean, it's really interesting how good this team is at attacking cover three, specifically because of how Hopkins and Fuller complement each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and for sure, even going back to that first throw, which going back against it, and like this, if you want a really good inclination of just how damaging Fuller can be, go back and watch Earl Thomas on that first touchdown catch. You'll see, like you said, he takes one step forward, and in that step, he shifts his body weight from his back to his front foot. And in that, he's no longer bouncing on his toes, essentially, so he can't flip his hips immediately. And in that, it's like barely even half of a second. That's far too late to stop Fuller, who was in full stride, by the way, from zooming straight past. And it was really kind of funny to watch afterwards. Seattle, what they occasionally do, considering they've got corners, they've had corners like Browner and Maxwell, and they've got, obviously, Sherman, is that in cover three, sometimes you play off and then bail into your zone. But Seattle usually like to press because they've got a very good reason to. They've got they've got usually big corners with really long wingspans who can jam right at the line of scrimmage and force receivers to essentially fight in order to get off the line of scrimmage. With the Fuller touchdown, they didn't. Shaq Griffin played off a little bit. He played, gave him like five yard cushion or so, and like Fuller eats that for breakfast. That's his raison d'etre. That's what he does better than anyone else. He takes gaps. He takes the space that you give him, and he burns you every single time. So one of the things Seattle did really well after that was they started to prey more and more press. And then you had stuff like Hopkins started to get open because Hopkins lives in press coverage. He really enjoys the hand-to-hand battle, creating space with his hands and creating separation off that. So it was a really, really interesting matchup to watch between how each kind of decision in coverage for Seattle was and how the Texans were able to manipulate against that. But yeah, like... Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just agreeing. I was just saying, yeah, like...
Yeah, no, but Fuller as a whole is just, he's insane. Like, even on the, I think it was his second touchdown catch, the Texans only had two receivers running routes on that and scene. They had seven in protection, mm-hmm. and still Fuller creates enough space in the deep third zone, which Sherman's covering, to just blow straight by and get in behind them. Like, Sherman, for those of you who are kind of familiar with basketball and know Giannis Antetokounmpo, who's the massive, like, just eagle-sized small forward for the Bucks, imagine a cornerback and imagine having that. That's what Sherman is. He's just a lot of wingspan, which creates not a lot of great throwing rooms. And this is what Fuller does. He creates space where you don't expect there's space to be. And that's just... It's so, so valuable, just more than anything else.
Yeah, you can just kind of see how much speed affects football specifically. I think you said it your best, where you can't coach speed and you can't do that. And I just think between the two, Hopkins and Fuller just for each other. They just complement each other so well. And it's just like really interesting. Like one of the things that you brought up that I've really noticed is just how many times they use max protection, have seven in, you fake the jet sweep, fake the handoff, fake the screen this way, and then Watson will take one step back and then throw it deep, and they're running a lot of those crossing routes, like you mentioned, with Hopkins and Fuller in the middle of the field and kind of rubbing off each other to confuse the safeties, and that's led to open scores as well, too. I know they did that against the Kansas City mm-hmm. Chiefs on Fuller's deep touchdown pass in that game, and it's been fun. I know I've broken down each one of the touchdowns that Fuller caught. I think I'm just going to do that for the rest of the year. Just to keep up with it, just as a fun way to waste. But do you think Will Fuller ever gets tired of catching touchdown passes at all?
I mean, he could theoretically, but then again, I think the drops would come back because this is the weird thing about it is that surely this can't continue, right? He can't keep doing this at this speed. But yeah, no, he's making up for all the ones he dropped a few years ago, or he just, you know, kind of bubbled. Or actually, yeah, this is all payback for the playoff game against New England when he dropped that one from He Who Shall Not Be Named. If this is the payback, then heck yeah, I'll take this.
Yeah, and then he threw for what? More than 400 yards. He averaged, I think, like 14 yards an attempt. A Fuller averaged more than 20 yards a reception. Just like, you know, some ridiculous numbers. But the only, I guess, one downside about Watson in this game is that he threw two interceptions. One was a pick six by Earl Thomas they took back for. Well, of course, you take a pick six back for a score. And, you know, this is the second week in a row that Deshaun Watson has thrown a pick six. And he's, you know, like one away from the Matt Schaub comparisons to start. And then he's one more week away from just everybody losing their mind, regardless if Houston wins or not. So that's something I would like to see. I like to see Watson just, like, keep throwing pick six every week and see Houston keep winning and just watch everybody just slowly lose their mind. So do you think this is, like, a rookie mistake thing with Watson? But he seems to have done this a couple of times. Or you think this may be just a trade that's going to stick with him where he's just going to miss a defender, look past him or through him, and make some, you just kind of make one or two really dumb mistakes a game?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think the Schaub comparison, that's gonna start a fire somewhere. Yeah, I mean, you want to just put it down to rookie mistakes, but then again, it's checks and balances, really. Do you take that pick six as being acceptable and with the understanding that this guy's eight games into his career, hopefully this will improve or just start to fall off over time. You'll see less and less. Or is this a systematic problem? Or is this something which we need to be on the lookout for? Is this the offset, essentially, for all of the good that Deshaun Watson does? Is he going to make two boneheaded mistakes a game? And is it going to be down to just how much can we limit on the rest of the side of the field to make sure that those mistakes aren't heightened to a degree? Because, yeah, he's giving away points, and let's not forget that's one of the key cardinal problems, that was one of the major problems with the Texans' offense last year, was that they kept on giving away the ball.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, we kind of saw the same thing though whenever he was in Clemson, where when they ran any sort of zone coverage, Nathan, a man above, he would kind of look past the linebacker and try to make throws that, you know, he missed and three interceptions like that. He got lucky, didn't throw more interceptions than he did in college because of it. So I think it's just something that he has to slowly have wean out of him. Because right now it's an issue. I mean, he pretty much threw a pick six against Jacksonville, two in his first start that didn't count. I know that Cincinnati game, there was one or two throws that he made where there was a defender dropping in underneath coverage and he just looked through him and should have been picked off. So I don't think this is something that's, you know, like just kind of some accidents that have happened. And, you know, it's a real, I guess, kind of, problem that he's had so far this year. I think it's like the only negative I've seen from so far this season. So it's just one of those things that you hope as Bill O'Brien spends more time with him and, you know, coaches him up and he spends more time watching video and playing the game, that he'll do a better job of recognizing those underneath linebackers that kind of drop up. And then also against, you know, teams that play a lot of 3-4 coverage or play up 3-4 sets, the Steelers especially love to drop guys back. I mean, I can already see TJ Watt pick sixing him right now. Those are kind of like issues that you can see, you know, moving on in the future.
Yeah, it's going to be the underneath zone coverage and stuff like that, and just being able to adjust for when defenses do stuff like that, like do drop a defensive lineman into like the short zone or a perimeter zone defender is just creeping in towards the zone or they're creeping towards the route. Like it's going to be stuff like that, and like we've already seen him manipulate defenders with his eyes. It's just, can he not get manipulated? That's the question.
Mm-hmm. Which one of Deshaun Watson's throws is your favorite in this game?
Oh, that's when I saw that question come up on the pregame thing, I was like, oh crap, it was like, what one is it? You have to go back and like, first and foremost, I love the first touchdown pass to Will Fuller. Not only that, because he actually does well to evade some pressure first off. I think it's Michael Bennett who's coming off the right side of the line, actually pushes into the pocket and Watson steps up and just, he hits Fuller in stride. That's Watching Watson's tape coming out of college, one of the big concerns that I did have of him was deep ball accuracy, because his release was a little bit wonky, and he always used to airmail it over, but he hit Fuller absolutely in stride. Like, it was 50 yards on a line to a receiver without him slowing down, and it was like a really impressive throw. And then there was third or fourth quarter, one of the last drives. Watson escapes from the pocket, bails out, and throws like a frozen rope, like on the move to Fuller down the sideline. It was like,
yeah.
It was just, that one I was like, okay, that's a pretty damn impressive throw. And then he goes on like two plays later and spins out of a sack and just flings one, or just like passes it off to Lamar Miller. Like, first and foremost, I think it's probably going to be the first one, just because it's a perfect example of good pocket movement, good pocket awareness, and then deep arm accuracy and deep arm strength. It's everything.
Yeah, my favorite was the one you mentioned up there at Fuller on the sideline. Just because, like, he's rolling right and he puts the ball right on the edge and gives Fuller, and it's like far enough from Richard Sherman where Sherman can't make a play on the ball, and it's right on the sideline where Fuller can get both feet in and toe tap and be able to stick that throw. And Fuller ran such a good route on that too. He ran one of those corner routes against Sherman and got, 3 yards of separation from him off his break. And Sherman's able to kind of accelerate and get close to him, but lots of the ball, like, right in the perfect spot. And again, like, he's rolling to his right, he's on the run. And that throw was just something else. So, like, I lost him when he hit that one.
Yeah, it was it's one of those things where you're just like, oh man, have we ever seen a quarterback do that? Like, have we ever seen a quarterback who is just in a full-on jog, essentially, or like in a sprint, move to his side and evade pressure, and then make a throw with that kind of arm strength? Like, I don't think I have. Well, or sorry, not from a Texans quarterback, at the very least.
Yeah, we haven't seen from a Texans quarterback. I don't know. Maybe when I was a baby, maybe Dave Ragone did it, or David Coney Banks did it. But best of my knowledge, no. But somebody did his own version of it. Whenever he would run those bootlegs where there was nobody in the zone, or he's like, meandering to his right and throwing the ball to the never like an actual run out there and tossing it up like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it would never be to somebody like deep down the field. It would always be like a 3 or 4 yard check down to like Owen Daniels or something. And it would just be, okay, here, there's the ball, go run.
Hey, you get paid to make first downs, not touchdowns, And then, the other big thing that happened in this game offensively was that Dwayne Brown came back. The Texans have a real left tackle again. And I don't think he could have come back at a better time, or I guess a more perfect time in some ways, too. But what happened was that Chris Clark injured his calf at the end of the win against the Cleveland Browns. So the Texans are looking at either starting Kendall Lamb at left tackle, potentially, and then having Giacomini at right tackle, and that Houston was able to stop that from happening with the return of Dwayne Brown to this team. And watching him this game, he looks like, Dwayne Brown. What did you think about did you watch him closely at all? Or did you notice him at all in this game?
I started looking back. The only time, like, when I was watching it live, the only time I really took notice of him was two times. I noticed him arguing with Xavier Seofilo on a blown block one play. And then I saw him get absolutely cremated by Dwight Freeney's spin move. I think it was like late in the third quarter or something.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, apart from the Freeney spin move, when I went back and watched them again, when I was watching him for the Bosa film room that I did last season, one of the things which stuck out to me was that he's not the fastest. He can get a bit sluggish sometimes, especially when it comes to over, and he tends to, I've noticed this, I think, overset sometimes on the outside, because I think he was expecting Xavier Seofilo to kind of have his back on, like, protecting against the interior, and there were a few times where I saw him kind of overset to the outside and, like, expecting a speed rush or trying to protect against the speed rush and then, like, have Dwight Freeney spin inside. Or there was another example which I saw, which was Michael Bennett just doing a real power step straight off of his right and, like, swung straight inside onto his left. It's kind of thing where I don't know if this is just, should Xavier Seofilo be, like, prepared to do that inside, or if it's Dwayne Brown intentionally oversetting towards the outside because he knows he can't really deal with speed rushes or any kind of that stuff anymore. But like, it's something worth watching, I think, for going forward. It's just how Brown, like, acclimates. Is this just, like, it's his first game back after, well, he was injured the year, he was injured last season, so he's been coming back from that, and he's had no training camp, anything like that, so I think it's going to take some time for us to see kind of thing again. But yeah, he was good blocking against, like, power rushes, speed rushes, anything on the inside which demanded him to have his usual kind of anchor. It was like, he was pretty good with that. It's when he was asked to deal with speed, he kind of struggled.
Yeah. My favorite thing about watching Brown play is just he's so wide. And so I know you're talking about, like, his pass sets or whatever. You know, like, even if he gets beat on the edge, there's just so much of him, and he's just such a – there's, like, a wall that even – like, all the movement it takes to get around him on the edge allows him to get beat by, you know, speed rushes and still be okay. And I don't – you know, I'm always kind of, like, in favor of the offensive line. And I think a really good example is that tweet that went – I guess, like, viral in football nerd, you know, loser circles. And there's five Seattle offensive linemen on the ground and, you know, like, four Seattle defensive linemen standing up. And everybody's like, wow, look how bad Seattle's offensive line is. When all the video was saying was that showing that it's a quick pass set where the linemen are going to cut somebody who's pretty much stationary. And the only point of that cut block is to keep their hands down because Wilson's throwing that ball immediately. And nothing at all to say that the, you know, Seahawks offensive line is bad. And so that spin move you're talking about with Brown, like, one, like, watching Freeney still able to use that spin move is just so spectacular. But I thought Brown did a pretty good job because he got beat and he recovered nicely and didn't give up the, you know, the inside rush and didn't give up a sack at all or anything. But, you know, Brown's been torched by that move plenty of times in his career. And there's that really famous video you'll see sometimes of whenever it was, like, Brown's, like, second year in the league and he just lunged forward and Freeney just destroyed him with that spin move inside. But Whenever I watched Brown this game, I thought in the pass game, I thought he was very good. I thought he, you know, pretty much contained that edge the entire game. You saw all the sacks and, you know, pressure that Watson dealt with. It all came from the interior, came from, you know, Suofio and Allen. I saw Manx miss a block. Allen had a really horrendous miss block against Michael Bennett. And so all that pressure was coming from the inside. Brandon Giacomini had a pretty good game, too, pass blocking. And he's been much better than, you know, I thought he was going to be entering this year. But the one I saw Brown have trouble in the run game, and I think that's kind of expected, mainly because it's such a, like, pass blocking is not physical. Like, it's a physical part of the game, but it's not physical to the point that it's in the run game. And so when you haven't hit somebody or been hit for, you know, what, since, you know, for 9-10 months or so, but it's been that long since you've actually hit anybody, like, it's hard to go from, you know, 0 to 60 and be, you know, smashing people around. And I just don't think Brown was really ready for the physicality of the run game. Michael Bennett had a few tackles for a loss against him where he was just beating him inside and Brown was, you know, not bringing enough of a punch whenever he got to the outside shoulder. And so I think once he gets used to the speed of the game, the physicality of it, he gets his hands stepped on a few times and he gets bruised up a little bit, I think he'll be, you know, much better already. But, you know, as of right now, like, he's still one of the best players in this offense. He's still a really good left tackle. And no matter about how you feel about him after, you know, the protests, or I guess, you know, the protesting and the holdout, you know, he's still a very good player on the football team. Now, like, did you see any of that stuff that Dwayne Brown may be traded, that the, you know, the ownership doesn't like him or whatever? Could you see that actually happening? Because the Texans are a playoff contender. He's a very good player and is very helpful for the football team to win games.
Okay. So could I see it happening? Maybe. I'm trying to declare myself from trying to make it objectively. I don't think they should. If just from the terms of Dwayne Brown is the best offensive lineman you have right now. That's not even kind of, or sorry, Nick Martin's kind of there, but Brown is still the best that we have. And any theoretical deal that we might potentially do would not be for any pick higher than maybe a fourth. And at that point, you're asking yourself, okay, do we want to trade away our backside blocker for Deshaun Watson so we can have Chris Clark for the rest of the year just so we can have an extra fourth rounder? I mean, no, like, why would you do that? It's not really – it doesn't seem like a smart kind of thing to do unless you're in the mindset that, Dwayne Brown's going to leave at the end of the season, and we should get something for him while we still can. But I don't know. I think if you're in that kind of mindset, then yeah, trade him. Go ahead, do that. If you think there's a chance that he'll still stick around at the end of the season, which can happen. DeAndre Hopkins went through a holdout the previous season, and he came back and got a 5-year deal. Then yeah, I would say stick with Brown, but could I see him actually getting traded? No, I don't think that's something which Rick Smith is actually going to go out and do.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see it happening at all just because of how good he is. I know that pass protection is as important when you have a quarterback like Deshaun Watson back there, but I mean, he still makes the team a lot better. I mean, for Watson specifically, like, he doesn't have to worry about pressure from his blind side. He only has to deal with rushers that he can see with Brown over there. And also, Brown just makes Sufio a much better player. They work really well together in the run game. And then also with Sufio, like, his biggest issue is that, one, he can't grab linebackers to the second level for I don't know why. He hasn't been able to do it since college. I think he has something blocked in his brain that prevents him from doing it. But he also whiffs really bad. And so whenever you have him and Martin, whenever you have Martin and Brown sandwiched between them, it really helps him in the pass game. And that turns that kind of liability into, you know, balances out. So, I mean, I think just performance-wise, where this team is at, I don't see them trading Brown. Brown's also under contract for next year. I know his deal is only worth, like, $6.5 million, so he'll probably sit out again unless he – and they may be able to work out, like, a Stephen Whitworth. I mean, an Andrew Whitworth sort of extension if they do that. And the other thing with Brown, too, is, like, I don't, a draft pick isn't really helpful. And maybe you trade him for, you know, some sort of pass-rushing help. Like, I brought maybe trading for Cameron Wake because Wake has another year in his deal, and the salaries matchup could be an idea. But there really isn't a whole lot that you can get for him at this point of the year that, you know, I think would make it worth it at all. And again, Brown's been on this team for 10 years. He's been spectacular. And I think it's all just kind of hearsay and speculation. There's no football reasoning behind it, you know.
No, there's not. Actually, going back to contract issue, I've actually wanted to ask somebody about this for a while. Xavier Suofilo is in a contract year. This is his last year of his deal. Do you think he gets an extension? Because I don't think he will.
I don't think he will with Houston. I think that team's going to sign him, though, and he'll start for a team next year. Because he's a starter in the NFL. Like I said, his one issue, he has those two issues, like I mentioned. And, you know, teams always love to, you know, sign somebody who has draft pedigree. You know, Womack is starting for New York Giants at right guard. He's been a much worse offensive line than Sufio has been over his career. So, and teams, and also just like the way offensive line deals went last year, the fact that guards are getting paid now, and, you know, Sufio is going to probably get like a $6 million a year deal or something somewhere else. I don't see him staying with Houston, though.
No, I'm just going to be really surprised if he gets $6 million a year. I think, like, I probably mistakenly, looking back on it now, but during our preseason predictions, I predicted Xavier Suofilo was the breakout player. I had a Derek Newton-esque vision for him, where he was like, oh, it's contract year. He's finally going to come good. And every week I seem to just see him give up interior pressure. Like you said, he whiffs quite a bit. His first punch isn't always accurate, and he can give up a lot of interior pressure, which is the worst kind of pressure.
Six is probably a little bit too high. I know whenever I first come with numbers off the top of my head, like, I'm so bad at trying to think about how quickly I can get somewhere. I'm so bad at, like, guessing the average, like, width or something, dimensions. Like, I'm so bad at, like, saying, oh, that's probably about a mile away. And so it's the same thing whenever it's first off my head. I'm always awful at that. But I think probably like 4, you know, 5. Like, he'll get like average guard money. And I think he'll probably get like, you know, at least $4 million a year somewhere. Because they'll start somewhere. That's about how the average that guards get paid now.
Also, that was a good point about draft pedigree. Because is Greg Robinson still with the team now? I think he was.
Yeah, he's just starting left tackle for the Lions.
Oh, bless! No way. He's still playing left tackle.
Yeah, he's been all right too this year.
Has he? Wait, I thought they kicked him inside to guard, and he was playing kind of okay there.
Pretty sure he's playing left tackle for him.
Huh.
They may have moved him back. They may have moved him back inside after, because their left tackle was injured, so then they signed him. I don't know. But yeah, he's been pretty good this year, though.
He's actually in a contract year too, as far as I recall. So he could be something he could be somebody to watch going forward. If it comes to pass that the Texans have top two picks from the 2014 draft in the year's time, that'll be quite interesting. Actually, speaking of the 2014 draft, Clowney, we got to talk about Jadeveon Clowney, because he was absolutely tearing up a bit of terrible Seattle Seahawks defensive line, but he was amazing. And the interesting thing here is, going forward, do we think he's going to be enough with Watt and Merciless both out?
Yeah, and that's really kind of the big question, because it seems like the Texans' defense is going to be bad without Watt Merciless in this game. Pretty much answer this question, because Seattle's offense has been mediocre this year; it hasn't been great, and they gave up 41 points to a mediocre offense this game. And I guess that was kind of the question, like, how is Houston going to make up for Watt and Merciless being out? And the answer is Jadeveon Clowney just being a defensive player of the year candidate. In this game, he had four tackles, two tackles for a loss, one forced fumble, one sack, or I should say one forced fumble, and one quarterback hit. But, he was all over the field. He was in the backfield over and over again. I think he probably – I don't know what the numbers were in the pressures. I need to look up what PFF said. But I assume he probably had, at least seven, maybe nine pressures or so. He was always in the backfield. And like you mentioned earlier, with kind of the Fuller comparison, where even if he's not stuffing the box score, he's still affecting every single play just by his presence and how much you have to, overcompensate to make sure he's moved. But he was just spectacular in this game. So do you think he's going to be able to do enough on his own to kind of make up for Watt and Merciless being gone?
No, but I don't think that's ever really been the point of Clowney, or at least that hasn't been his role so far. If that, like I said before, he's always been just such a great big distraction for the offense and the offensive line that anyone else is essentially just gonna have to get in there and finish the job. But with Clowney now, we've actually got to get down to the point of having him finish, because that's been one of the things which I've noticed with Clowney as a whole, is that a lot of his sacks as a whole are oftentimes quite lucky. There was the sack of Brady in New England. Or sorry, there was the one where he beat him on the edge, but then he had another one where Brady essentially just fell over. He knew he was the first guy to touch. And then again, you had it again this weekend with Wilson, who's an incredibly mobile, very active. The thing with Wilson is that you kind of need to get him on the ground. You can't give him extra time. And this is the kind of place where you need Clowney to be finishing plays. He only had, I don't know how many pressures he had, but according to GSIS, which is Game Statistics and Informations, he only had one quarterback hit on the day. So and that was probably the fumble. So it's the kind of thing of, he's getting close. It's just he needs to be able to finish it full time. And I don't, until he shows that he can do that, that's always going to be a bit of a lingering issue. He does everything else so well, and he impacts the game in so many different varieties. It's this one impact. It's the box score impact, which is actually holding him back. That's the tail end of it, really.
Yeah, I think it's kind of the difference whenever you look at J.J. Watt's career before the Texans wasted his prime and Clowney. It really makes you appreciate what Watt did with the numbers he put up. Whereas just the margins are so slim, the difference between a sack and not a sack, and Clowney just doesn't. I don't know what it is. He just is just missing that last 2 or 3% of his game, and maybe it's just quicker play route, or maybe where he's lined up, he's lined up too far outside. But for whatever reason, he has the impact on the game. He's close a lot of times, but he's not the box score Watt has done, Aaron Donald does every game. But I mean, I think for sure, he's the best player on this defense now. I think he's a legitimate year candidate, and he won't win, or he probably won't even be nominated. He won't have the box for numbers. The Texans defense is going to be really bad, but I mean, he's just so dominant. What he did on Sunday was spectacular. I think it's one of the best games he's ever played. Now, do you think this is more the result of Seattle's offensive line being really bad, or do you think Clowney is just going to be just a monster from here on out without Watt Merciless around?
I think it's a bit of both. I think this was definitely a game where Clowney, every single snap, you saw him driving a Seattle Seahawks defensive lineman 3 or 4 yards back in the field. He had that one snap with an Eddie Lacy rush. where instead of stacking and shedding, he stacked the offensive lineman and then threw him into Eddie Lacy, which is, you know, unique and effective, as it turns out. But yeah, it was he pretty much had his way the entire day. And listen, I really hope that this is the start of, again, Clowney just turning it up another gear. I can't believe we can actually still think of Clowney as just having, oh, he can actually get better, but yeah, he still could. Whether or not he will, that's gonna be hard to tell. I mean, he's gonna see better offensive lines for sure. The Seahawks offensive line isn't good. If you weren't watching that game, it's not good. Jermaine Ifedi is constantly committing constantly committing penalties. Ethan Pochich is only starting his like second or third game. Those are the right guard and center. And then the left tackle, who I cannot remember the name of, he was just getting beaten every single snap by Clowney. But yeah, like he's going to see better offensive line this year. I think the Steelers game is going to be a really good inclination of just how far Clowney might be coming, because he's going to be seeing some good offensive linemen, I think.
Yeah, watching him Villanueva play against each other is going to be fun, because Villanueva is like, you know, 6 foot, 13 inches tall or whatever it is. In that play you mentioned where, you know, Clowney drove the fullback into, you know, Teddy Lacy. I remember that play he had in the Chargers game last year where the tight end, you know, swings around to the other side formation to block him, and he crashes him and tosses him into the running back to tackle Melvin Gordon for a loss that, you know, Brian Cushman got credit for the play, but it was Clowney throwing the fullback into him to pick up that tackle. And also in that play, too, he had a tight end blocking him, and he swims over the tight end, then jams the fullback into Eddie Lacy and brings him down. And Lacy's so weird to watch, too, because it's like watching Marshawn Lynch just, like, in slow motion, because they look the same. They have a similar body type, but it's just, like, it's not the same guy. And so you kind of feel like you're just in a different universe, a different reality that we're all simulated in. But with this defense, you know, it was really bad. And I do think the one thing that's going to happen is that I think the run defense is still going to be good. In this game, they gave up only 3 yards to running backs, and I believe on 16 carries. The rushing numbers will be inflated to that 1.6 they ended up with, because Wilson, I think, ran for 42 yards. And yeah, it was all just pretty much on, you know, the run defensive side. And I think with, you know, DJ Reader in the middle, with Clowney, with Bernard McKinney, with Cunningham, who's played, you know, really well, all those tackling issues that he had coming out of college, which he had, you know, even though he's tackling well right now, he's had to learn how to be a better tackler. He's been very good this year, too. And then whenever you go on the other edge, you know, with Scarlett or whatever, it doesn't really matter that much. But because of those, like, you know, three main components with all the other complementary players there, as long as they tackle well, you know, they're going to have opportunities to, you know, go unblocked and, you know, wrap guys up and make some plays for, you know, make a bunch of tackles for 3 yards and that sort of thing, because of how good Reader and McKinney and Clowney are. So I do think the run defense is going to be good. Do you agree with those statements?
Yeah. I mean, actually, I can see a roadmap for success for the Texans, especially on defense, through this. Like, we got to late in the third quarter and the Seahawks were in negative rushing yards. Like, that was insane to watch, and to just keep following as the game went along. But yeah, the Texans are going up against a series of teams late in the season who rely heavily on their own game, would be a bit of an understatement. You're looking at playing Blake Bortles again, C.J. Beathard, Jared Goff, Jacoby Brissett, Carson Palmer, and Joe Flacco. All of those teams don't want those quarterbacks to throw the ball much. So they're going to rely on the run heavily. And if the Texans defense can just shut down the run and focus on shutting down the run, they're going to be putting the ball into quarterbacks' hands in situations which they don't succeed in. Like, you can look through Blake Bortles' numbers on third and fourth downs, and you can see, like, his quarterback rating and his completion percentage, they all take a big drop. These are situations which they don't want, like, the offense doesn't want to get in. And that's all brought about by teams shutting down the run and denying guys like Leonard Fournette, denying guys like Carlos Hyde, stuff like that, early yardage on the downs, which makes the field shorter. So there is, and I do think the Texans defense can still do this kind of well. like you said, Reader is really, really good at occupying a lot of blocks. And if nothing else, this the defense as a whole, and like under Romeo Crennel, Mike Vrabel has always kind of preached this idea of the guys up front are usually eat blocks, and then the linebackers kind of flow through the open spaces to get to the running backs. And if that can kind of happen at like 2 to 3 yard intervals every single time, then that's perfectly good. I can take that, and that's what the Texans should be looking for, like damage assessment and kind of restricting everything to a certain degree and forcing the game into the hands of quarterbacks who aren't that good. That's where they're going to win this season if they're on the defense.
Yeah, that's interesting too, because I didn't really think about the quarterbacks that they're facing this year. And because the big issue for this team on the defense side is the pass defense. Russell Wilson threw 452 yards, 4 touchdowns, 1 interception, which is like 2010 Texans defense sort of numbers that we saw in this one. Tyler Lockett and Paul Richardson each had more than 100 yards receiving. And so with the Texans, not only for this game but this year, what do you think is the bigger issue, the pass rush or the pass coverage?
Okay. Well, if we're talking about in reference to the Seahawks game, it's pass rush, because you can't give Russell Wilson time. We saw that on Richardson's first touchdown pass. He bought like three or four seconds of extra time by escaping the pocket, and eventually somebody's going to get open. That's the key crux of this. Somebody is always going to get open, no matter how good your defense is. Or sorry, no, how good your back at your secondary is. Eventually, somebody's going to get open. So the onus has got to be on the front seven more than anything else to kind of take away from the back end's deficiencies. Not to say that the back end isn't liable for a lot. They're liable for a lot. They're not good. There's only just brief, fleeting moments where you see some semblance of competency sometimes. To the point where the piece that I wrote about the New England secondary struggles a few weeks ago is now completely redundant, because two of the players that were starting that day are no longer on the roster. Or sorry, one of them is no longer starting and one of them is no longer on the roster. So
yeah.
Things are constantly in flux back there, to the point where you just can't take anything as being like, okay, this is going to end well. So you've got to manufacture production elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think it's the pass rush, too. I mean, the secondary isn't good, but I think it's the pass rush, too, just because it's only Clowney. Like, whenever you go, like, a four-man rush, you're bringing out, like, Carlos Watkins, DJ Reader, Covington's out for you with the torn bicep, and Joel Heath, Brandon Dunn. Like, all these guys I'm naming, like Brandon Scarlett, these are, like, third quarter, week three of the preseason sort of guys that we're talking about here. Kamalu, Justin Houston, like none of these, Kendall Langford, who's one of the worst free agent signings ever in football, that was went largely unnoticed. But they don't have anybody there that's any good as far except for Clay. Athletically, they're just spaces. So It was different last year where they were able to manufacture interior pass rush with Clowney, and the secondary was so good last year that they were able to make up for it. I don't think the secondary is being able to be good enough for that. But just as far as talent, Jonathan Joseph, Kareem Jackson, Andre Howell, and Kevin Johnson is a lot more talent than we have right now, which is just Clowney, maybe some more interior blitzes from but there really isn't a whole lot there from the pass rush perspective.
Yeah, no, we are if we're not running on empty now, then I'm close to having an empty tank. I mean, there's only so much you can really do in terms of It's damage limitation. I think that's what the defense has got to be from here on out. It's just, let's not have 40 points dropped on us every week. If they can manage that, then hopefully Deshaun Watson and the offense can continue their ridiculous ratio of scoring, and hopefully the Texans can find a somewhat formula for some wins for the rest of the season.
Yeah, and it's so weird that we've gone from, can the offense score 20 points, to can the defense not give up 30 points for Texans to win? Because that's what has to happen now.
It's so stupid.
It's just being alive is just such a strange thing to have to go through. The coverage, though, so like Kevin Johnson's back. He had a bad game. Marcus Gilchrist was completely terrible. I think he's been hidden you know, really well throughout this year. Teams just really haven't been throwing the ball deep aside from the New England game. And you wrote like a really great post about how New England attacked Houston, their cover four and cover three defense that they ran that game. And he was really isolated and attacked over and over again. You know, Kareem Jackson still isn't turning his head. He'll never learn how to do it. He should watch The Exorcist and say, hey, you know, if only I could do that, I'd be a Pro Bowl cornerback, but he can't do that. His head's on a fixed thing of vertebrae, I guess. And then they also get that really silly 66-yard catch. Richardson made some spectacular catches like he always does. Jimmy Graham caught some touchdown passes. But, you know, overall, they're pretty much able to do anything they wanted to do. Now, I guess, like, I have a few questions here about the secondary. And the first one's Kevin Johnson. Like, what do you think's up with him? Because he's been bad all year. He was bad in week one. He wasn't very good during that first quarter of the Cincinnati game before he got injured. And he's been bad, you know, in this game as well, too. Do you think this is from the injuries, even though he was bad whenever he was healthy? What do you think is going on with Kevin Johnson?
I do think the injuries are going to starting to show a little bit. We've had, what, two surgeries on both feet or one foot? I think we've had one foot definitely was broken, and now we've had an MCL tear also, and then there's been a few other niggling injuries which have kept him out for a few other things too. Yeah, he was looking labored, I think is the word that I'm looking for, especially on that second Richardson touchdown where Johnson was tracking him across the back of the end zone. Yeah, Johnson just looked he looked like he was struggling to keep up with him a few times. And like there were a few occasions where I saw Johnson actually having really good placement and getting his hands up and being able to deflect a few passes, but he didn't look 100%. And that's going to be something to definitely watch for the rest of the season, because oh boy, do we need him to be good, because if he doesn't play, then it's Marcus Williams, and I don't want Marcus Williams to play. Especially after what Paul Richardson did to him this weekend. If you want a really fun analysis of statistics to look at, go look at the game chart for Paul Richardson, and just look at the wonder that is the amount of out routes that he had completed to him. He had seven targets, and six of them were completions on out routes. All of them, I guarantee, were either against Kareem Jackson or Marcus Williams. He was just abusing the Texans when it came to just outbreaking routes constantly. But yeah, Kevin Johnson's gonna be I don't want to jump the gun and say he's bad and he's just suddenly become very bad, because we've seen him and he has talent. And talent doesn't just suddenly go away. So, like, we saw that with Amari Cooper. It was just like he had a few struggles for the first set of weeks, and then suddenly he had the 200-yard game against the Chiefs last week. So talent doesn't vanish. So I'm just wondering, what is it that's holding the talent back right now for Kevin Johnson?
Yeah, and they've played so many few games that, like, you have one bad game that really sticks out with you. But I mean, he was great last year until he got injured. The issue I see with Kevin Johnson is that he's such a guy that depends on his not his reaction speed, but his, you know, his speed whenever he breaks on the ball. He's a guy who does like that kind of Jalen Joseph thing where he plays, you know, 4 yards off or so, you know, takes like two step backwards, and then once he reads the route, he reacts and breaks on the ball. And he's able to break on the ball so fast that he's able to have a larger cushion. And, you know, this game he was trying to do that same thing, but he was just missing that one weird kind of tackle out of bounds he had that was almost called for a penalty was an example of that. That first down he gave up on the sideline to the out route's another example where he's just not able to break on the ball like he's had previously. And so I don't know if he's entirely healthy or what's going on as far as that, but I'm with you the same way. Like, talent doesn't stay bad forever. You know, he should be better as a little bit more time goes on. But I don't know entirely what's up with him. That's something that to really worry about, because that's what Houston was banking on this year. They didn't re-sign AJ Bouye. They should have franchise tagged him. They didn't. But the reason they didn't was because they had J.J. Watt coming back and they had Kevin Johnson coming back, and they assumed that Johnson could step up for Bouye and they wouldn't really miss that much at all. And the opposite has happened. So I just think it's a health thing, because that speed should still be there. It doesn't disappear. And he's not able to do it. It makes him so good at his game right now at the moment.
Yeah, much like everything else which has gone wrong with the second season, it revolves around just staying healthy. That's the unfortunate thing about this. Going back to the Boye point, it's just like, yeah, you can kind of take that away and imagine that the net losses and the net gains will kind of balance out, but we kind of need for Kevin Johnson to be good. Otherwise, we're giving snaps to corners who, quite frankly, aren't good, and put the Texans at risk every time they step on the field.
Yeah, I think this pass defense really is going to depend on Kevin Johnson being better, because he's the one wild card there. Like, Justin Houston, like, having 8 sacks isn't going to happen. Joel Heath all of a sudden becoming a great player doesn't seem like it's going to happen because he's played for a while. There's really, like, no, like, you look at where things can maybe improve, where guys can get better. Johnson's, like, the one spot where you could see something like that happening. It just hasn't happened yet. So I don't know. I think he's really kind of the key to this pass defense moving forward. Now, I know you mentioned Marcus Williams. Who's your least favorite player in the Texans secondary right now?
Oh, no. this is genuinely a hard question, because I still have fond memories of Marcus Gilchrist from the New England game, where he came in and did some very, very cool things. I think he got a sack on Brady on a safety blitz late in the game.
Yeah, that free rush he had.
Hey, listen, okay, if you can't do the free ones, then you can't do anything, okay?
Yeah, that's true.
But he had a few good moments in coverage, and yeah, I mean, that the late deep completion that he gave up to Richardson, that was just woeful positioning. But I don't think he's the worst one. Williams, and I want to say it's Marcus Burley. Give me a second here.
He was there for a bit.
Yeah, this is the thing. Like I joked about it earlier. It's just like the Texans are kind of in this weird mode for defensive backs right now, where it's just they're flinging stuff at a wall and seeing what sticks. And for a few weeks, that was Marcus Gilchrist. But I don't think that could be the case anymore, to the point where I think Curtis Drummond was getting a few snaps. Let me just check the snap count here. Okay, Curtis Drummond got
a little bit.
Yeah, he got one snap. He got one snap, and I remember it because it was the Jimmy Graham first touchdown in the end zone, and Drummond was just standing there going, Oh, he just caught a football. Dang it. But yeah, so, I mean, you could bring back in Eddie Pleasant, but then again, he kind of works well as a kind of nickel and slot guy, just for coming in and manning up against tight ends. But worst guy, yeah, I think it's got to be Williams right now. I have to do a little bit more looking, but not like, I think one of the best things I read was Dead Coach when he said, Kareem Jackson is—he's a good defender, but he's not a great corner.
Yeah, it's
which
great.
It's such a really apt comment when it comes to describing Kareem Jackson as a whole. It's just like, oh, this guy—he's good at something. It's just that thing isn't really directly pertaining to the role that he plays on the field for like 80 to 90% of the time. So I'm kind of annoyed by that, but yeah, no, it's hard to pick who's the worst part of that secondary right now. I'd have to go with Marcus Williams just because he was default really, really bad. But I think you could make an argument for Gilchrist if you wanted to, but I won't because he's my boy. Yeah, I'll leave it at Williams for now. And I look forward to, in about 2-3 weeks' time, writing about a completely new set of defensive backs because these ones are probably just going to get cycled in and out. Until something sticks, until we find another AJ Boye or something like that.
Yeah, well, that will never happen because there's only one of those men. There's only one man like that out in the world. So do you think the Texans secondary, or not necessarily just the secondary, but do you think the Texans pass defense, with it being as bad as it's been this year, I guess as bad as it's been at times, do you think that it can be good enough for this team? Or is it going to be the ultimate downfall for this team by the end of the year?
Oh, okay. It's hard. It's hard to really say there because ultimate downfall implies that it's going to be a problem every week, and that's going to be contextually based on who they're facing every week. And if a team really wants to go out there and attack the Texans secondary deep, they will have success. Whether that team has the capacity to go do it, we're going to see. Like, if you're the Jags or if you're the Niners, do you want to give the ball to C.J. Beathard and Blake Bortles 30 times a game and go, chuck it deep, they're really bad? That's what it's going to come down to more than anything else. Do I think, like, in a vacuum, they're not good. And they are a liability. But whether that will be exploited, we're just going to have to see. I can't say for certain.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I mean, it's really, can the defense, like I mentioned earlier, it's really, can the defense hold, you know, team to 30 points or less? And if they can do that, then Texas has a chance to win every single game that they play just because of how good this offense has been. And again, like this Seahawks team that they play, you know, their fifth and pass defense, DVOA, I actually think this is probably the best secondary that the Seahawks have had because Shaquille Griffin has been great. Earl Thomas has been great. Richard Sherman's been one of the best cornerbacks in the NFL this year. I know we had to put it, you fill something out for like a SB Nation NFL season awards or whatever. I thought Richard Sherman is defensive player of the year because he's been so good. The Seahawks have such a good secondary. Their pass defense is their best part of that team. And just like, I mean, just look at the numbers, look where they're attacking teams. Like, no one's even doing anything towards the side of the field at all. And he's been just, you know, awesome. So for what Houston did, like, I think it said a whole lot for them moving forward for this game. And it's, you know, it was spectacular. And it's also just so much fun to watch Deshaun Watson play and watch this team in this form. It's, you know, even if the results are less, or let's say they win less games, this season is so much more fun than was last year because losing 41-38 is a lot better than being the Lions while you're hungover, you know, 17-13.
Oh, hell yeah. It's like watching one of Mike Leach's teams. It's like watching Washington State. They score like 50, 60 points a game, but that's no guarantee that they'll win. But it's still fun to watch. And
yeah,
I think that's probably going to be my goal for the rest of the season, is to just enjoy watching a really good offense for once, and try to not rip my hair out at watching the secondary, you know. But hey, listen, Watson, it's all good. Positivity.
Yeah, it's weird watching this team right now because I really wasn't even that upset. I was upset at all after they lost yesterday because watching Watson play as well as he has and just knowing that there's a quarterback there and expecting, you know, some regression to the mean in these one possession games. I was, you know, expecting that some. And so like, I can't really be upset just because of how good, you know, Watson has been this year, even though Bill O'Brien does his best to kind of thwart his efforts with, you know, in-game management and conservatism. But that's it for that Seahawks game. It was a lot of fun. And this week they're playing the Indianapolis Colts. Now, originally we planned to preview this game, but I really don't want to as I start thinking about this Colts game more and more. So I have one question for you. Do you think Andrew Luck plays a snap this season?
Do I think? Yeah. Okay. So here's the thing. I'll say yes, because I actually believe the Colts are that stupid. And here's why I think that they are that stupid. I think at one point in the season they're gonna take a look and they're gonna say, yeah, we can't like say around about week 13, week 14, Andrew Luck is gonna be actually healthy to go, and they're not gonna be able to stop him from going out there. And I don't think they're gonna say to the rest of the team, hey, listen, Andrew's healthy, we're gonna sit him for the rest of the season. I don't think they can do that. They should. Let me explicitly state this. They should. The Colts are not a good team. They are really, really not a good team. And the fact that you would be forcing the best part about your team, your quarterback, who is easily the best decision that they've had to, the best like front office decision that they've made in the past 5 to 10 years or so, has been taking Andrew Luck. And that even was not a hard decision. It was like a, hey, listen, you've got the second coming of Peyton Manning here. Oh sure, we'll take that, I guess. But yeah, I can see them doing something stupid and playing Luck. They shouldn't. They really like keep him on ice for the rest of the season. Allow yourself to go 2-14, reap the rewards in the draft, and then come back next season and with a better team, with a healthier team, because they've also lost Vontae Davis too, if I'm not mistaken, who is their number one corner. And actually try and go forward from there rather than forcing the rapidly bald Luck into a situation which is just not going to do him any good.
Yeah, I mean, I think if Luck was just dying to play, he probably would maybe play. But, I mean, there's just no reason for it. I think also like keeping Jacoby Brissett in there as much as possible isn't the worst idea in the world, because you could probably get a third-round pick for him this offseason, and a team will probably, you know, maybe take a chance on him as their starting quarterback, because he's been, you know, pretty good this year, especially considering, you know, coming to this team late and all that, and also, you know, the talent around him as well. But, you know, I hope Andrew Luck doesn't play. I want to see Andrew Luck be good at football, because I think it's, you know, quarterbacks are such a special commodity, and it, no matter who they're playing for, who you're a fan of, you don't want to see them be wasted, you know, entirely, like, you know, Luck has been wasted the past 3 years. So, I don't know. I want to see Luck play. I'm hoping it's be next year. They should have a high draft pick, off plenty of cap space, and they should be able to, you know, use it to invest moving forward next year. So, what can you name one thing that the Colts do well?
I mean, they've got a good punt unit. I mean, the punt unit has a lot of practice, and currently they are ranked, the best punt unit, according to DVOA, from Football Outsiders. And their special teams, DVOA, is also seventh in the NFL. Apart from that, that's about it. So, you know, watch out, special teams, Texans special teams, because things might be looking bad. I don't know. Listen, Jacoby Brissett's going to play football, man. I can't get excited about that. I can't get excited about a team that's going to actively go out there and say, hey, Frank Gore, carry the ball like 25 times a game. You're only 33, right? You'll be fine.
Yeah, it's weird. And it's also weird, too, because like, the Colts were one of the best teams in the league at running the ball up the middle with Gore. And you know, Ryan Kelly's one of the best centers in the NFL. And so that combination of him and, man, I'm so stupid, that left guard they drafted from Ohio State, I can't remember his name.
Jack Muhor.
Yeah, they had a great combination. Their right guard was, you know, fine. They used Haig over there, and you know they were good. They ran the ball really well up the middle, and a lot of that has to do with Gore too, and his kind of always feet moving, always falling forward run style too as well. But I don't want to talk about the Colts anymore. What's your prediction for this game? How much do you have the Texans winning by?
I'm gonna put it. Wait, how much do they win by, or the final score?
Yeah, final score.
Final score, I'll go 42-20 Texans.
I'm going to go one touchdown less. I'm saying 35-20. And I do think Jacoby Brissett probably hits, what, you know, one or two deep passes. I think they'll be able, because he has such a good arm, and mm-hmm. T.Y. Hilton hasn't been traded yet. But I guess he'd be traded by tomorrow, so who knows how that works out.
Yeah, no, if T.Y. Hilton gets traded, then, you know, deduct maybe one or two touchdowns away from the Colts' final score.
Yeah,
he's worth that much to them, really.
Well, we have thankfully, you know, that we have plenty more time, so we're gonna play this game that we came up with called Ireland Doesn't Have It. Now, one of the things about writing about, you know, football for this Texan side for SB Nation is you know, the memories and the friendships that you make. And one of the things that we have is we have email threads that we talk to each other in, because we still have a lot of older gentlemen on our masthead who don't know what Slack is. Because all the cool, you know, SB Nation sites and all the cool kids running them, and millennials all of Slack that you see from people I've talked to in other sites over the time. But we have email threads, and so we all get to have fun in those. And one of the things that I kind of learned about myself through is that I don't know anything else about how the rest of the world works. I know America, and that's it. It's the only place I've really traveled. I haven't really left the confines of it, except for the one time I went to Costa Rica in high school, but that doesn't really count all that much. And I don't know anything at all about occurs the rest of the world. So a lot of our threads go, me wondering what Luke has in his area of Ireland that he lives in, whether they have this, that, or some other thing. And so that's how this game developed. We're going to play Ireland. Do they have it or not? Do you have anything you want to add before we get started?
I mean, like, to give a little bit more backstory, this kind of spawned from I have a general interest in the U.S. as a whole, and like there are certain things which I come across just due to the fact that I'm a lot in like U.S. circles and U.S. people, and I occasionally come across stuff like the U.S. I've noticed a certain lot of Americans don't like mayonnaise or have very strong takes about mayonnaise to the point where I just messaged everyone in the email and was like, yo, what's the deal with mayonnaise? To which Matt, beautifully, and when I heard it the first time, I was like, he's not serious, right? He asked, does Ireland have mayonnaise? For the record, we do have mayonnaise. But yeah, I thought that it would be a an educational experience to ask just, you know, what a certain country has. So I've got 10 things here. I've got a list of foods. I've also got a list of, like, cultural events, things about Ireland or things which might not be from Ireland. I'm going to simply ask, Ireland, do they have Funyuns, Matt? Do they have Funyuns? The onion ringed maize snack.
I would say yes. I think snack food is such an American thing and has permeated the rest of the world society. So I'm going to say yes, Ireland has snack food.
Okay, so we do not have Funyuns. Funyuns, I believe, are made by Frito-Lay. And Frito-Lay aren't really that big over here. You'll find you'll find very niche stores which will sell us, but not in the it's not really in mass circulation. Instead, Ireland has a local snack making company called Tato. Now, Tato's very big, and they have their own onion ring based snack, which is called Johnny Onion Rings. Johnny is like the name, essentially. The best part about it is the packaging of this comes adorned with essentially a very, like, a Frenchman, like somebody wearing a striped vest, t-shirt, a beret, a mustache, and like a really piggy looking nose. It's this, like, an Irish company essentially trying to sell you onion rings by using a Frenchman. It's bizarre, completely bizarre. But yeah,
you'll have to take a picture of Johnny onion rings.
Oh shit, yeah, I will totally do that.
I also love how it rolls off the tongue too, because it's pretty much just and it kind of rhymes with Johnny Appleseed. I just think that's entirely beautiful.
Johnny Onion Rings, yes, there you go. So, moving on to question number 2. Ireland, does it have crawfish?
I'm going to say no, because I don't know, they got swamps in Ireland, I think. Or England has swamps. There's a big old swamp critter. I'm going to say no, but I could be likely, because they're in swamps and small tributaries. I'm gonna go no.
That was a beautiful description of England. I want you to forever when it comes up on the site how to describe England, I want you to do it just because I know you're gonna come up with something like, ah, it's just a big swamp. But yes, Ireland does have crawfish. We have right white clawed crawfish, if I'm not mistaken. Let me just check here. Yeah, white clawed crawfish, which are typically found in streams in Tipperary and Limerick, which are both in the southern part of the country. Very interesting to note, by the way, that specifically American crawfish contain a certain pathogen, or actually it's a disease, which if it ever made its way over to European crawfish, and Irish ones in particular, would kill them and cause their extinction. There you go.
And, you know, I should have stuck with it. I read this book called The Mention of Nature, and a lot of it, it's all about Alexander von Humboldt, and he's, in South America, and he can't believe some of the things, the plants he sees here are similar to things in Europe, but it's just slightly different. And I should have recalled that information and stuck with my gut and said yes. So I'm very upset with myself right now.
Don't worry. There's no way you can redeem. You've got 7 more chances to redeem yourself, okay? So, next question. Ireland, does it have Taco Bell?
Yeah, it has Taco Bell.
It is Taco Bell? Is that your final answer? Ireland does not have Taco Bell. It's really quite shocking because for those of you who are kind of aware, Five Guys Fries and Burgers, which is a staple of the East Coast, that's made its way to Ireland. But Taco Bell hasn't. So I'm thinking there's a distinct thing about quality and letting in only certain fast food chains. But yeah, we don't have Taco Bell, which I'm kind of glad for, I think, because I don't
have you ever seen an enchilada or a burrito before?
I have seen some of the abominations which they regularly market to people as food. I'm not terribly enticed by it, but I could see how at like 2 in the morning after a few really bad beers you could probably go, yeah, I'm gonna put this in my body. I could totally be down for that.
Well, so, here's the argument for Taco Bell. One, I eat meat only once a week, so I eat meat very sparingly. And sometimes you're on the road or you want to get something fast to eat. and all fast food has meat, but you can go to Taco Bell, you can get two bean and cheese burritos with some potatoes in for like $2.50, and you know, you're fine. And they also, like, the hot sauce is pretty good too. You put enough hot sauce, anything, it tastes okay.
Oh, that's interesting. So it's more of just a general convenience kind of thing more than anything else.
Yeah, and again, it's hard to find fast food that doesn't have meat unless you're just going to eat, like, French fries, you know?
Yeah, I hear that. Okay, that's a good one. So, yeah, moving on, though. Ireland, does it have a Memorial Day?
Yeah, but it's not in May.
Incorrect. We do not have a Memorial Day.
Oh,
we don't. We don't have it in the typical sense of we don't actually have a day off for it. It's not like a national holiday. This is mostly down to the fact that Ireland as a whole has been a neutral country. Specifically in World War II, Ireland was one of the, I think, it was only two countries in proper Europe at the time, which were neutral. Neutral to the point of being just a bit douchey. There's one really good anecdote about the war that when Hitler died, I think. Yeah, when Hitler died, I don't remember the exact year. The Irish Prime Minister sent a letter of sent his condolences to the then German Chancellor at the time, essentially saying, sorry for your loss. Sorry for Hitler dying. Which, you know, is a bit weird, considering, and like, the Americans and the British didn't forgive him easily for that afterwards. But yeah, we don't really have a Memorial Day as a whole, because Ireland has been mostly seen as a neutral country. But yeah, moving past that, onto something a bit, I don't understand how this thing exists. Ireland, does it have Cheese Whiz, as in cheese from a spray can?
I'm just going to start doing the opposite of what I thought. I'm going to go, yes, it has Cheese Whiz.
No. Are you kidding me? No. We would never tolerate the existence of this threat to the culinary arts on our land. Like, this is one of the things that I'm genuinely happy that hasn't migrated its way across the Atlantic. Like, have you ever had Cheese Whiz or Cheese Whiz from a can?
Yeah, I remember the first time I had it, I was like, 4 or 5 years old, and I ate like 3 cans of it and just thought it was the best thing I've ever had in my entire life.
What the hell, man?
Just like plowed through it. It was on like New Year's Eve, you know? I was like 5, it was on New Year's Eve, and I just watched The Great Mouse Detective and ate like 3 cans of Cheese Whiz.
Okay, question. Do you get different types of cheese, or is it all just one uniform cheese?
No, I know there's at least 2 different types, because they have one with the red cap and one with the blue cap.
Wait, it's color coordinated. It's not even coordinated by like the actual cheese that they use. I'm assuming they use cheese.
Yeah, it's all infantile memories. But I remember there's one with the red cap and one with the blue cap.
Oh dear. But yeah, cheese whiz is the one thing I never want to see in my life. that is just disgusting. Okay, so moving on from Cheese Whiz onto another food. Ireland, does it have habanero peppers?
Yeah, I'm going to say yeah. Well, I'm going to say no, because I would say yeah. I'm going to say no, they don't have it.
You are just like Bill O'Brien. You snatched the feet away from the jaws of victory. Ireland does have habanero peppers. We have...
This is amazing.
It's a learning experience, Matt, okay? You don't learn anything if you don't fail, okay?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Habanero peppers are actually... they're not commonly grown, like they can't grow indigenously, but there are lots of small refineries and small farmers who are actually going out of their way to produce habanero peppers, and there's actually one farmer in the next town over who produces actually a very, very nice habanero sauce, which I will actually find out what it's called again. But yeah, habanero peppers in Ireland, they do exist. We are quite fans of hot food. All right. Here's a geographical one. Ireland, does it have a mountain taller than 4,000 feet?
No.
No, it does not. Correct. You're right in the money. The tallest one is Mount Carron Tuathail, which is down in Cork, again down in the south. It's part of the McGillicuddy Reeks, which is the name of the mountain range, which is one of the best ones, which includes also a mountain by the name of The Bones, also quite funny. But yeah, Cameron Toohill is about 3,100 feet in total height. But yeah, none of them come close to 4,000. All right, question.
That's even taller than I thought it would be, because like there's some, you know, states here in America that are around the coast and their tallest mountains like, you know, 400 feet above sea level, like New Hampshire, for example. But now I guess I'm really underrating the elevation gains Ireland has.
Well, we don't really think of it as mountains. We just think of it as like a steep incline.
Yeah, more big old hill.
Yeah, this is the big old hill. There's actually a really good story of each year there's a mountain called Croagh-Patrick, which a bunch of sort of Catholic nuns and monks walk up barefoot as like a kind of pilgrimage, like walking up a mountain essentially that's 300-400 feet above sea level, completely barefoot, walking on like shale and rock and all that stuff. But yeah, you know, that's Ireland for you. All right, here's another one. Ireland, does it have one quarter of its entire population living in one city?
I'm going to say no.
Oh, you're wrong. We do. There is such a massive disparity in Ireland when it comes to population. So the total population of Ireland is about 4.7 million as of the census, which was conducted in 2016. Now 1.4 of that is condensed into the county of Dublin, which is where the city of Dublin, which is the capital city, relies. So yeah, everyone and their mother lives in Dublin, essentially. So one quarter of the population. So there you go. It's really quite disparate. Everything kind of focuses on cities and nobody likes living in the country. Question number 9. Ireland, does it have marshmallow fluff or marshmallow cream?
Well, that goes hand in hand with Cheese Whiz. So you have Cheese Whiz, I'm going to say no, it does not.
Hey, he's learning, folks. Yes, we do not have marshmallow fluff. We do have peanut butter. We do have crunchy peanut butter, which I can't for the life of me understand why people like Smooths.
Oh, damn, I love that.
I cannot do crunchy. Smooth is totally the way to go. I live and breathe for smooth peanut butter. That stuff is the best. But yeah. We don't have marshmallow fluff. Another thing, much like the Cheese Whiz, I am glad that we don't have marshmallow fluff. That stuff sounds disgusting.
That stuff's an atrocity is what it is. It's an absurd atrocity.
Okay, finally, the last question we have here. Ireland, does it have freedom from England?
Is it like, I don't know. I know it's like a province, kind of, but I would say yes. It's free of England.
You know what, Matt? I don't care that you've got maybe more than half of the rest of the questions wrong. You got this one right, and that's literally all that matters. Yes. Yes, Ireland is free from England. And that's, for any Americans out there, that's all you really need to know, is that there's a Republic of Ireland that isn't involved in England, and there's a little bit right up at the top that's Northern Ireland. That's actually English now. But if you remember,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's there's two separate countries on one island. I kind of should have led off with that. That seems like it would be important. But yeah,
I knew that they had Northern Ireland, but I never had any idea what the hell that was and what it meant. I didn't know that was English Ireland, and the rest is Ireland. But yeah, it makes sense. It's weird though. It's like if Texas had like a little sliver by the Rio Grande border that was still like had allegiance to Mexico or was part of Mexico. Or like right after the Rio Grande River. But yeah, we don't have that. But it pretty much is Mexico down there though. It's very pretty.
Yeah. I mean, like it's kinda like the whole Basque thing that's going on, or sorry, the Catalonia thing. It's a sliver of land within the country that's made up of people who don't identify with that nationality. And that's probably, I think, the best way I can describe it. But
or like
yeah,
Quebec. Kinda like that.
Or Quebec, indeed. That's actually another good example. there's plenty of them where just cities are just cities and bunches of people are just like, nah, we don't want to be stuck here. But yeah, that's it. So you've got Ireland and you've got Northern Ireland. Those are the two key things. Is there anything else? Well, you've got me in a way we can expound upon things, or even just like general other countries. What do you want to know, Matt?
Well, I've finished 3 for 10 this week. And I'll get you back on later in the show again, and we can play the inverse of it where I ask you if you have things in Ireland or not. Or we can play Texas doesn't have it, or San Antonio doesn't have it. And, you know, I feel like this entire thing is putting me in a really stupid light. And my problem is now is that, you know, I work every day. I like a real American, go to the factory with my lunch pail every day. And I use my brain up at work. So then whenever I come home, I just turn it off and just become as dumb as I possibly can. And I feel so stupid right now. And I'm so embarrassed that I only went 3 out of 10. And I just heard the words come out of my mouth. And I need to go back to school because I've gotten too dumb. But it's a very fun game. We can play the inverse or Texas as we have it. And we can do it. I think Thanksgiving week would be the best week to do a Monday show, only because I'm going to Grand Canyon and I'm going to be out for the rest of the week after that day. So maybe we can play it for it then. Can we play Ireland? Does it have Thanksgiving, you know?
We don't. We have nothing to be thankful for. We're just really, really quite angry and grumpy. Anyway.
Dublin's is really good. And Dublin's is a very good book. I read The Dead every Christmas time.
Why? Oh, wait. Is it just... Wait, you... Oh, man. That's really weird. Like, The Dead's quite a depressing story when you get down to it.
Yeah, I read it every Christmas. The one that stung me the most, though, is that one about the kids who play hooky. And then I don't want to say the word on the podcast, but he's pleasuring himself. And they don't say it. They just use the word whipping over and over and over again. And that was the first time I learned about the power of literature when reading that story in high school.
Yeah, no, that was certainly one of the ones which stuck out to me from Dubliners also. It's just, okay, I'm gonna put the book down right now because I don't feel comfortable reading this. But it's definitely a very, very good and interesting collection. Also, don't read Ulysses, any of you. It's not worth it. The payoff is not worth the payments that you're gonna put down into it.
Interesting.
Also, yeah, no, I can't. As somebody who spent a large chunk of his college life reading Ulysses, it's not worth.
And you can't get those days back either.
No, I can't. And listen, this is the thing. There's a really good, another good anecdote about Joyce and Finnegan, I think it's Finnegan's Wake, which is another one of his books, that one of the German and French translators for us spent 15 years of his life translating it, because the English and the language that Joyce used was just so incomprehensible. It wasn't really language, it was more just sort of various blatherings, that once he completed it, he had a nervous breakdown and checked himself into a mental hospital. And that's all you really need to know about Joyce, is that it will drive you insane.
I talk about Joyce for another 50 minutes, but we've exhausted all the time on the countdown, probably about all the patience, but this is fun to do. This is, well, I did the Blade Runner thing as well. Well, Chris and I did a review of Blade Runner, I guess, 2 or 3 weeks ago. But, thanks for being on tonight, Luke. It was great. I learned a lot about what you got out of the Texans-Seahawks game. It was a really fun conversation to have. And Ireland doesn't have it. Some version of it is going to be my new favorite game to play. You don't need a video game system. We got fun games like this.
Yes,
but thanks for being on tonight. Thanks for listening, everybody who listened live. I don't know if anybody even did or not. But thank you for listening. If you like the show, tell your friends. If you have anything that you're wondering if Ireland has or not, ask away. I'm sure Luke will provide you some beautiful answers. But
happily so.
To live or listening to the show, we'll be back on next Tuesday, live this time at 7 p.m. Central. But thanks for being on again tonight, Luke, and have a good night.
No problem. Take care, Matt.
That's pretty good.